I know everyone's very excited about the sunshine outside. That was an unexpected treat as we get ready to close out the two-day conference, the 2005 CICD Symposium on Learning Innovations. The good news is, as we head down to Ensemble Collaboration out of the base later this afternoon, hopefully the weather will hold, and we'll see little bits of blue sky and less rain. Hope everyone had a good morning this morning. Hope your sessions went well. Hope you enjoyed the coffee break. We put some extra sugar into the coffee and into those little desserts there, so you should all be pumped up. We got an exciting panel this morning to go through. Just some housekeeping things first. The buses that are going on the site visits, there's two. There's a lunch down at Ensemble Collaboration, my company. Then the buses will be leaving for that at 12:15. For those that are driving down to Ensemble Collaboration, there's maps at the front desk. It's just down the hill, down by Queen Square Park, for those that know the route, just a couple blocks away. Those maps are at the front desk. Again, buses leave at 12:15. After lunch at Ensemble, the buses will come back here and then leave for the base. You can leave your luggage here at the Roo Center when you go down to Ensemble Collaboration, because the buses will come back up, pick up anyone else, pick up the luggage, and then go off onto the site visit at the base. For those that are driving to the base, there are also directions to the base as well, and Captain McDonald will be at the front desk after this session to take you through that process. And he just stood up and raised his hand in case you didn't see him. And now he's raising both hands. So he's getting real excited. The other thing, too, is I want to take time just to mention and call attention to a very special person that really drove the success of this conference. Steve Kelly, are you in this room? Steve Kelly, right at the back. Please, everyone, give Steve Kelly a round of applause. Interesting enough, Steve works for the provincial government here. He works for Business in Brunswick, and he is one of the most motivated, energetic person I've ever seen, and he personally contacted many of you that attended this conference, and on our side here in New Brunswick, was a great motivator, and every day he was giving us the daily updates as to how many people are registered, how many are coming from XYZ and all the rest, and if it wasn't for Steve, I suspect at least half you people would not be here. So again, Steve, thank you very much for that. Kind of sad, this is our last session together and the last session of the day. But what we're going to do now is we have a panel session on the future of learning. And what I want to do is take a few minutes to introduce the different panel members and also our moderator. On my far left is Jay Cross. Jay Cross is the founder of the Internet Time Group. And he's also the managing director of the Workflow Institute, which promotes understanding of real-time enterprise-level learning in industry and government. If you haven't read it, Jay has a very popular blog called the Internet Time Blog. I read it almost every day. But I should mention that Jay is also chairman of my board, so of course I read whatever Jay says every day. Jay is a big advocate of informal learning and collaboration. Those two topics certainly over the last 2 years have really started to gain a lot of prominence as we start to understand that a lot of people learn around the water coolers, out in the hallways, in an informal way, in addition to the structured formal way, like today's sessions. And again, one of the things we were trying to do at this conference was that blending. Time out, big coffee breaks, lots of breakout sessions, structured and unstructured, so that people can learn off one another, in addition to the presenters. Now, right beside me is Stephen Downs. He is a leading voice in the areas of learning objects and metadata, as well as the emerging fields of web blogs, in education and content syndication. He is the senior researcher at the National Research Council, Institute for Information Technologies, e-learning research group. Likewise, Stephen also has a very popular blog called Online Learning Daily, or OL Daily as well, the other blog that I read every day as well. His work also includes the development of educational content syndication systems, such as EduRSS, DLearn, and the design of a digital rights management system for learning. Sitting in the middle is Dr. Robert Pearson, president of Provident. For those that don't know it, Provident just recently made an acquisition here in New Brunswick where they acquired LearnStream, one of the leading e-learning companies here in New Brunswick. Dr. Pearson is an authority on e-learning, distance education, and technology-based learning, with over 20 years of high-level practical and academic experience in the field. He is responsible for defining Provident's business strategy and directing the largest full-time staff of senior e-learning professionals in all of Canada. He's worked with a wide range of private and public sector companies and has designed hundreds of instructional and informational products, including online courseware, web-based performance support tools, and educational television programs. So a very interesting, diverse media background. Dr. Pearson is also credited with many evaluation and needs assessment studies, including strategic planning initiatives for large corporations. He holds a PhD in education from Department of Design, Development and Evaluation, Syracuse University, and an MBA from the Rotman School of Business, University of Toronto. And he's also had over 50 publications as well. So again, a very esteemed, knowledgeable group that we'll soon be putting through the paces. As our moderator for today is Lisa Neal. And Lisa Neal is editor-in-chief of eLearn Magazine and an e-learning consultant. She is project manager for Plymouth Plantations, You're the Historian, investigating the first Thanksgiving, a recent winner of an MIMC award in education. I've met Lisa several times, gone to numerous presentations by her, and today she's a moderator, but she's also an excellent speaker in her own right. Now, in 2003, she received the United States Distance Learning Award for Most Outstanding Achievement by Individual and Corporate E-Learning. She holds a PhD in Computer Science from Harvard University, and today she is fielding questions from both the audience here, and we cross our fingers, the audience that is joining us remotely online as well. So I will turn it over to Lisa. Please, round of applause for the four people today.
Let me start by saying it's really an honor and a thrill to be here. I've been up in Fredericton before, and I enjoy it enormously. And I was just delighted that Gary and Lynn took the trouble to arrange for me to be here for this. This is also fun for me. As I was flying in yesterday, I realized that I normally spend my flights preparing my talks. And it was great to just be the moderator and not really have to give a huge amount of thought to what I was going to say, but instead just only think about the structure. Also, I just as an aside, I'd like to say that of our three esteemed panelists here, two of them are eLearn magazine authors, and I hope the third one with 50 publications under your belt will soon be as well. How many people here were at the breakfast this morning? Okay, a good crowd of you. So I just want to acknowledge for those who weren't there, we had a really interesting breakfast this morning that was led by Jack Smith from the Office of National Science Advisor and Jonathan Kaloff from the University of Ottawa School of Management. And they're here from the Privy Council Office. And can you guys stand up and so people can see who you are? So they facilitated a really, really interesting session this morning, and we see the panelists kind of branching off from that, and what we wanted to do is to really get your questions for our panelists here. And before we start with, it's coming, okay. Okay, so while we're waiting, I'll ask what I think is really the most interesting question of the conference, which is, who has the most hair, me or Stephen? Since we don't have Illuminate to do polling, I'll just move on. Stephen actually answered the question himself. I took the liberty. I don't know Stephen well, and I didn't want to embarrass him publicly, so I took the liberty of asking him if it was okay to make a hair joke. And Stephen said, well, he thinks I have more, but his is more distinguished. Okay, so we don't have our question up today, but all of you have some cards in front of you. And so what we decided to do is instead of the microphone, like we did in the session yesterday with Clark, what I want, the cards here are for you, and I'm just going to warn you that if you don't write a question down, you're not going to be allowed to leave the room and go on your tours. So take this as a serious responsibility. And the question that I wanted to ask everybody, which I had so nicely worded on the PowerPoint slide, is what would revolutionize your personal or professional life related to learning over the next 2 years? In the session this morning, we were taking a much longer horizon, but I think for a lot of people to envision even 2 years into the future can be quite a struggle. I know it is for me personally. So instead of looking at, say, 2020, if you can just take a planning horizon like that. And it may be that you came to this conference with a lot of questions and you've gotten some wonderful answers to them. But what we have here are some really unique perspectives. And I'm going to start by throwing a question out at the panelists while you are all writing your questions down on the cards. And by the way, we have three people, Joanne up in the green, and we've got Norma here in the tan jacket, and Lynn, where are you? And there's Lynn. So if you have a great way, when you write a question on your card, just raise it slightly in the air, and whoever's closest will pick up the cards and bring them down to me, and then I'll be posing the questions to the panelists with a little bit of editing. it's so nice to be powerful. Okay, so I'm going to start with a question that I'm going to give each of you, and we'll start with Stephen, which is, what do you think is the future of LMSs?
Well, I think the future of LMSs is limited. And I think the reason why the future of LMSs is limited is that learning is going to be moving toward a more personal and more personalized model, where the center of learning will be the individual learner, and learning content from multiple providers, not just including companies and universities, but also including their friends, people they don't know, people from around the world. This content will be brought into the personalized and personal learning environment.
Okay, that's great, Stephen.
That was short, it's too.
it's a future I certainly agree with. Rob, do you want to take a stab?
Sure, maybe go at it from a slightly different perspective. I think, and I would absolutely agree, I think the future is limited. It's limited because I think the business model around LMS is problematic. Software business is a tough business to be in. And the LMS companies have generally really struggled because a lot of times they don't work so well. So from a kind of business dynamic standpoint, I think the wave of excitement around LMSs is waning.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, I'll take yet another tack on that. LMSs only measure the results of formal learning, which is maybe 20% of the way people learn stuff on the job. But if we think of total learning, also got to think about what people forget, which, you know, is about half of what they hear within a day, and other things that, you know, lack of relevance, out of date, make it not always optimal. I don't think it makes sense to have a specialty software application to measure maybe 5% of the learning that goes on in an organization, and even if it does, it'll become part of an enterprise application in an interoperable world. Goodbye, LMS.
Great, thank you, Jay. It's really delightful having each of you come at something from your unique perspective.
I wonder how many LMS manufacturers we have.
How many people like these visions that are being portrayed here?
There you go.
Great. Okay, we've got our first question in from our audience. Everybody's there writing your questions because I know you can all multitask. What is the biggest threat to the e-learning industry in Canada? Let's start with Rob. I bet you think about that a lot.
Yeah, too much some days. And it's interesting because I think we touched on some of these points this morning in our excellent dialogue. We need to do a better job of driving applied research in our universities and our colleges that support the e-learning industry. We need to do a better job of preparing folks with the right skills to participate in the industry. I mentioned this morning, in the United States there's about 60, 63, 65 graduate programs in instructional design, and there are none in Canada. And we need to do a better job as an industry relating to government and relating to higher education to make sure our agenda is out there. So those are things we got to take care of, and we got to take care of them in the short term, or we're going to find the competitive situation pretty tough.
Great, Rob. Thanks. Jay?
Well, rather than do the usual ugly American thing, I'm not going to presume to know what Canada needs to do.
Right, well, that was good.
Got that one.
Well, I'm still going to presume to tell the United States what to... No, I'm kidding. Biggest threat to e-learning in this country? Microsoft, Disney, and similar companies. And the reason why is that the production capacities, well, even of just Microsoft, let alone Microsoft and Disney and Time Warner and so on, dwarf our production capacity, which means that if Microsoft or Disney or any of them decide to move into the market held by pretty well any of the Canadian e-learning companies, that company is toast. Because who can match that kind of capacity? Who can match that kind of research? And my concern is, and I've expressed this concern before, that if we play by the rules that are set out by companies like Microsoft and Disney, that sets us up for just that sort of scenario. Because I do know that both of these companies have moved and are moving further into the e-learning space. And the sort of rules that I talk about are rules along the lines of proprietary technology, closed content, firm hold on copyright. We cannot compete in that kind of environment where people own particular bits of things because Microsoft owns it all, and we can't compete against that. The only way this country has a chance in e-learning is if we share.
Great, thank you, Stephen. Jay, we'll start with you on this. I think this is a fantastic question. How can we work more rapidly and effectively with our own brains, minds, and memories, our ability to learn and remember? As our resident cognitive scientist.
Oh, Lord.
Questions like that will do it.
Well, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to give my little screed on a thing that I see affecting just about every aspect of learning. And what I term, do you have free-range chickens here? I think of free-range learners who go out and they sort of pick their food rather than just what comes by on the conveyor belt.
Yeah.
But this, to my mind, goes back to something that I was in the born in the midst of, and most of you came later, namely World War II. Now, World War II was such a wonderful success, not just, Canadians and Yankees arm in arm going and fighting the bad guys, but the methods that were used were so powerful that we ended up with corporations that mimicked the military and had, all of a sudden, they had officers and they had command and control systems, and they were very concerned about strategy and tactics and titles and promotions, and they would use competitive weapons. And frankly, that is now totally obsolete. The military has given it up. If you look at the, Vietnam taught us, hey, doesn't fit anymore. It's better to have small guerrilla fighting groups and coalitions and deal with things as they come. And I see all business structure changing to something which is much more flexible and loose And we've talked about learning objects. I think about process objects where whole parts of businesses are outsourced. There's a wonderful role for Canada in grabbing some of the right pieces there. But it means that learners have to be more flexible too, and that each of us is going to become our own instructional designer. I mean, there's a lot of talk about learning to learn. I've led a group on learning to learn for 5 years, and we still haven't been able to get a corporation to cough up more than 50 cents. Because it's sort of a nice thought, but people don't worry about processes. Well, now we're going to have to worry about processes, because that's going to be the key to success, is making your own plan, figuring out how to get there. As far as techniques, there are zillions of them. I'm writing a book on informal learning, and I'm soliciting techniques. And the ones that get published in the book, I give people a free copy of the book, so I'm up for volunteers. But things like, if I have to solve a problem, it's a big one, I don't try to do it consciously. That's too hard. I just tell myself before I go to sleep at night, I want to wake up with an answer, and by golly, there's an answer there waiting when I'm through. There are hundreds of things like this that all of us can use to our advantage, as long as we don't pay too much attention to teacher and the old command and control model.
That's great. Thank you. Rob?
I think I forget the question. But
do you want me to repeat it for you?
No, that's okay.
I didn't know if you were joking. It's okay. You can answer it then.
That's what I call learning.
Maybe just building on previous comments. I think one of the places that we really need to give some focus around starting to create learners who learn well in an informal way, learners who are self-directed. We need to start in elementary school, and I think there's a real lesson here for our ministries of education and around curriculum to make sure that we begin to form learners who will be able to take up a challenge.
Thank you, Rob. Stephen?
I'm just reacting to the concept of forming learners, which I'm not quite sure how to react, but it doesn't feel right. I mean, we're moving into something I'll characterize in a very hackneyed and cliched way, because I'm doing this off the cuff, as something like the age of empowerment, where we're moving from a period of time where learning is something that we provide, learning is something that is given or processed or delivered to the student, to an environment where learning is something that people learn to do for themselves, so that the learning provider becomes, at best, a learning facilitator. And I mean, I understand what you're saying when you talk about the elementary schools, because right now, my perception, I could be wrong, is I'm not in them a lot, which is, because I graduated. but I still don't think that we're doing as much as we could to teach people how to learn. I have two big things that I think everybody should know by the time they're out of kindergarten. Number one is basic logic, reason, critical thinking, as it's called sometimes. And the other one is how to learn, how to go to the internet and find out what the capital of France is and know that you've got the right answer. And that's the direction that we should be headed. And I think that's where the markets are, too. And I have to be conscious that I'm talking to a more of a commercial audience here. I think that the markets are not in providing things for people in the model of a content provider or a vendor or a distributor or a broadcaster, but giving people tools that they can use to create their own learning.
Let me build on that just a moment, because I mean, I've worked with a lot of vendors, and typically they have in mind sort of the standard learner.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an assumption, you know, if we're doing modeling and we've got somebody who's our representative avatar, it's one. But if you think about it, there's a learning life cycle which goes on. So kids, indeed, we need some curriculum because they need foundations to build on, and we don't want to have to reinvent everything. And later on, informal learning and discovery become much more vital because you're building on the foundation you've got. So, you know, I like to sort of get right to it. Curriculum is for kids. Discovery is for adults.
Yeah, I like that.
That's great. Thank you, Jay. Okay, I've got three questions that I'm going to group together because they're quite related. And what they have to do with is, what are your visions of what schools are going to be like, how schools are going to change, or how you would like to change them, in particular related to learning and pedagogy? And Rob, since you touched upon this before, let's start with you.
Sure, and I think we've been touching on some really interesting notions already. I think back to a video I saw a few years ago, and it was a pilot project that was run out of, and I'm not sure I'll get the name right, either the Northeast or the Northwest Regional Educational Lab, federally funded out of the U.S. And these were grade 6 students, and they had this amazing approach to I think the topic they were engaging with was glaciers. So the focus of the project was to create some kind of tangible artifact, some kind of tangible deliverable. And I think the particular group that this video focused on, it was a movie or something like that. There was a person in the group who was appointed as a project manager, who had to coordinate all the tasks of the group and make sure that each of the components were delivered on time. They had to use technology to create the various components, and they had to interface and interact with learners who were in schools around the world, again leveraging technology. And I just thought this was what an amazing vision of what learning can be. Very discovery oriented, technology enabled, but not technology driven, and all the kinds of ancillary sort of day-to-day important skills we need to know in our lives were woven into learning the content: project management, media production, writing. It was great.
Speaking of discovery learning, I just discovered a new difference in pronunciation between Americans and Canadians. I would say ancillary. Mm. I just make mental notes of these things, but it is discovery learning, right, Jay?
There we go. Or I put a U in it somehow.
Do you want to take a stab at this, Jay?
Ancillary?
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm divided on this. I mean, everybody's got an opinion on school. We all went through it, and we all have ways to improve it. So I can easily criticize school of 40 years ago, but today I'm not so sure. One thing is, I remember having to, even in the U.S. you have to do this sometimes, memorizing the kings and queens of England, or the books of the Old Testament, or, God, there's some awful poetry that kids have to memorize. The difference that I think of today is that the unit shouldn't be what you can do on a closed book exam, but what you can do if you've got a high-speed net connection,
yeah.
Because that's what's going to, lead to achievement and happiness and other things. We no longer have to be tested as if we just came out of the cave or something.
That's wonderful. I'll certainly agree with that, Jay. Stephen?
Yeah, that's a good segue. Let's redefine cheating. I've proposed two things. This isn't the answer I was going to give, but I'll come back to the answer I was going to give in a minute. But I have proposed two things, only half in jest, and the first one has to do with cheating. And I say do away with cheating by doing away with the definition. Encourage them to cheat. Anything they can do, anything they can get their hands on, any resource, if they want to work together, great. If they don't want to work together, no problem. If they want to call up Jay and get the answer from Jay, rock and roll. If you can do that, you should get an A because you got the right answer.
So that's part of it. And the other thing I would change is grading. I would change grading to a system of random evaluations by your peers that are deliberately unfair and not based on any measurable criteria. Because that's how it works in the real world. And the segue from that to what I really wanted to say is this. Schools are, by design, artificial environments. We talk about virtual learning. The most virtual learning is what takes place in a school. I mean, we put them in little boxes and make sure nobody can go in and that they can't get out. There's fences. What technology gives us today is mobility. We can go anywhere and be connected. We can go anywhere and create content. We can go anywhere and communicate with people. I've had conversations with Jay across the continent, across the planet. So why do students need to be in these little sterile environments? I've always thought that the best place to learn about a forest is in a forest. The best place to learn about cooking is in a kitchen. The best place to learn about, well, you know where that's going, right? Never mind. That's not what I had in mind. But the point is, learning should and will become doing. And instead of having learning as something separate from the rest of our life, learning becomes part of the rest of our life. I mean, it would be really silly if we all got up, went into a little room and said, we're going to do some learning now, and then once we're done learning, then we'll go live the life. Imagine if we did that with writing, right? Let's all get on. We'll go to the writing room. That's where we can write. And then once we're done in the writing room, we'll come back out and we're all finished. We can't write anymore because we're not in the writing room. That's what we do to kids. So the technology makes learning as easy as a pen. Well, it's not yet, but it's getting there. And when learning is easy as a pen, learning should travel with you and be a part of your life the way a pen is. So what's the future of schools? If it was up to me, it's not. People are much smarter than that. But if it was up to me, I would be working at getting rid of schools. I would be working at making the school day smaller and smaller and smaller. I'd be working at getting students not just out into the community, but being a part of the community so that the schoolwork that they do has and can be seen to have a measurable, well, I don't want to say measurable, but a visible impact on society. They're not working in a fake world anymore. They're working in a real world. And we give tolerance, you know, give room for errors and things like that. People have given me lots of room for error, and they still do. So we give at least that much room for you know, children for error. And you don't let them pilot 747s, but you do let them train in a flight simulator. And that's the model, I think, that we do want to move toward. That was longer, sorry.
Thank you, Stephen. Longer, but very interesting. Okay, Stephen, your ears will perk up at this. We have two questions related to blogs. And
right.
One of them comes from one of our online participants who wants to know, how do you think blogs or wikis can be used in a business environment, and what are the risks and challenges? And the related question is, are corporate blogs more hype than reality? So let's start with you, Stephen.
Oh, and you want this in what, 30 seconds?
I'll give you a minute and a half.
Well, there's no power in that power bar. I just realized I'm running on batteries here. Isn't that odd? Never mind. Oh, no, I'm plugged in. Oh, well, anyhow, we'll see how long my battery lasts. Blogs. There is a role for blogs in a corporate environment. I think there's a very important role for blogs in a corporate environment because people have seen through public relations and they've seen through marketing campaigns. So all the very carefully massaged image that you see corporations project isn't believed anymore. What people do believe are the voices of individuals, the voices of people. People writing honestly, people writing without editing, without being told what to write and what not to write. And it turns out in practice that this is probably the best marketing that a company can get. Microsoft launched its blogging initiative with Robert Scoble. Its image in the internet community probably dramatically improved over, and I was going to say doubled or whatever, but that didn't make sense, but you know what I mean. So I think there's the marketing aspect, but also to, I'm not sure how to phrase this. Do you remember when Pentium had that thing where they had a processor and it made adding mistakes? If there had been a blog, somebody could have just blogged it. They could have just gone, our processors make adding mistakes. We've got software that fixes this, so it's no big deal. And, you know, it's only at, you know, the 8 millionth decimal place, but, you know, these things happen. That would have solved the problem. Instead, it turned into a big, huge embarrassment because they tried the standard corporate line response where we will manage the news, right? But if it had just been, you know, the honest voice of an engineer in the back room talking, and, you know, they would have been talking about chip development all along, and you can almost turn it back on the blogosphere and say, you know, why didn't you guys spot this? You know, because the customer actually, in this case, helps with the design of the product. It engages, puts you as part of the conversation. I'll let these guys talk about the risks because I've talked too long now.
Okay, as our other, at least well-known blogger on the panel, you want to go next, Jay?
Well, I have too much to say on this topic, but there's also an application within an organization which can be extremely powerful. If you're, say, implementing enterprise software, which you'll find is a Murphy's Law all the time, 24/7. If somebody sets up a blog just around the project that we don't believe what it says on page 37, that's nonsense. Hit the red key. It goes fast. Right now in Iraq, the main source of information for company leaders comes from a blog that was set up by two guys, totally unofficially, their own money, but it tells how people were killed the night before. And everybody reads it and contributes to it. It's a lot more understandable than the stuff that the Pentagon would have put out, which had, of course, been months late anyway. Mm-hmm. There's a two-way thing with what Stephen mentioned. Recently, I got a phone call from an outfit called Stamps.com. And they said, sign up for our service. There's no obligation for the first 30 days. You get $25 worth of postage. We will send you a digital scale and back out any time. I said, all right, go ahead and send it. Figuring, you know, a month I'll blow these guys off. And, you know, a month goes by. I call up. And after 30 minutes, I thought, I'm not waiting anymore, you know. And so I called up a few days later, and they said, well, you know, you've signed up for a year's worth of service at $16 a month, and you've got to pay this. And I said, you know, this is crazy. I used no service. You're going to have your broken scale back. But it was, you know, no, we can't do it. I said, do you have a supervisor? Well, the supervisor had been trained to say that he didn't have a supervisor. There was no recourse. And I was steamed, and I've dealt with many large corporations like this. So I did notice that they were publicly held. So I went to the SEC filings and got the name of a few people and wrote them an email and just said, look at my blog. Because I described exactly what I was told. and how they said there was no recourse, and that I would have to pay for a service even though I didn't receive it, that this was totally fair and this was their company's policy. Well, at first they blew that off. So I looked at my alumni directory, and sure enough, the CFO was a graduate of the same school, so I got his home email address and sent him and just said, can you guys afford to treat people like this? And bingo, you know, blog power, apologies all over the place. Now, I'm even today, I got another thing on my blog, these bastards do the same thing to me. So, you know, maybe we'll get them to have a recourse on that. There are a lot of internal corporate blog projects going on now. Some of it's like when Apple computers showed up in offices. Nobody could get budget money. CIOs hated it. So you'd have a requisition for $2,000 sofa, and it would come in a little box with apples on it. So there are some legal issues in a day when you can recall email. If people are blogging and blog from home, and maybe they've had three martinis and they tell what they think of another person, that can be very nasty. And we don't have our laws don't deal with that well.
Rob?
Maybe just a couple of quick thoughts. And I'd agree with everything that's been said, that healthy organizations do foster and encourage discourse. But at the end of the day, there's good ideas and there are ideas that maybe aren't so good. And there needs to be mechanisms within organizations to sift through that and to provide focus and to provide leadership around the way forward. That leadership doesn't necessarily have to come from the top. That leadership can come from anywhere in the organization. But without leadership, and without that organizational focus, you can end up with chaos. And that's not good for an organization either.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. Thank you for adding that. Am I allowed to make one quick comment? Okay, as long as Gary says yes. Well, the one thing that unless you said this, Stephen, and I missed it, none of you talked about the ties between blogging and informal learning and the extent to which you learn from reading people's blogs, and I would also argue the extent to which you learn reflective processes and writing skills by creating a blog, which you've got to agree with, Stephen.
Yeah, but there's a but. I mean, blogs are a transitional technology. They exist now, they're big now, they're huge now, but they're a transition. They're the medium point between personal content creation. So I don't tend to say things like, blogs will do this, blogs will do that in learning per se, except insofar as blogs are a stepping stone toward the technologies that will do that. I talked a little bit earlier about the personalized e-learning, the e-learning application that will sit on your desktop. The stuff coming into that today would be from blogs that are created by other people or technology that produces content like blogs. I mean, that technology exists now. It's RSS and content syndication. By the time this actually becomes mainstream, we'll probably be more post-blog. And so people won't be saying, well, you're getting blog content on your e-learning application. They'll be saying, you're getting PMM, personal multimedia content on your personal application. I just made up PMM. It doesn't really exist. Don't run out and trademark it.
Okay, we've only got
13 minutes.
Actually, less than that.
Less.
Okay, we've got two questions that are related, having to do with what are the devices that are going to help learning, especially if learning is doing. So, for instance, how can you use tactile, haptic, smell, music, text-to-speech, speech-to-text, etc., in order to improve learning for the future? Let's start with you, Rob.
Well, another example comes to mind. Again, a great example of how multimodal learning can really be effective. And again, an elementary school application. It's interesting, just as a sidebar, I would contend that the most innovative stuff that goes on around learning tends to be in our elementary schools, and that's really interesting. So here was the project. It was a project on urban planning, and so they got a group of kids in the Netherlands and a group of kids I think in Toronto, and their task was to design a city. And they worked collaboratively at a distance to actually physically build a mock-up of the city using big blocks. And so they engaged with the content with their hands and their minds, and they also did it at a distance. And so you'd have a learner in Toronto saying to another learner in the Netherlands, well, let's put that building over here, and they'd move it to another part of the grid. And very, very powerful. And you know what? That stuff's very simple to do. It just takes creativity and a little passion.
It's a great example. Thank you. Stephen?
See, I think something like that should be part of the Planning Commission and should work in cooperation and coordination with the actual City Planning Department. And then not only do they, and of course they do their models. I mean, and the answer you gave was exactly the right answer. How do you get tactile stuff? You get them off the computer, you have them work with things, like coffee cups. Whoops, that's got coffee in it. You almost wore a whole cup of coffee. But not just that, they work with the models, they work with the schematics and that, they work with multi-user SimCity, and then they walk downtown and they look at what last year's class designed. The urban improvement, and 20 years later they walk and they say, this part of the city was designed by my grade 7 class. That's how you get tactile.
Okay.
Well, briefly, learning is a whole body experience. If we just concentrate on heads, we're missing 90% of it.
Sure.
I'll just throw out one additional perspective. I had the opportunity to interview Don Norman. Don is the author of, most recently, Emotional Design, The Invisible Computer, The Design of Everyday Things, and is one of my heroes, present company excluded. And one of the things that Don talked about that I just thought was such a brilliant idea is how music is used so evocatively in movies to control your moods or to give you heightened anticipation, to let you know when something is important. And why isn't music used in e-learning? I thought that was just an interesting idea, and I thought about that in reading the question, because it may be that there's an awful lot of room for creativity in bringing in other senses into learning.
Yeah, but you got to be careful, though. That's really manipulative, right?
I know.
Unless students have the background in media analysis, they're not going to have the tools at their capacity to know that their emotions are being shaped by this background music. I mean, programs like 60 Minutes and that do it all the time. And the poor audience, they have, to a large degree, they don't know what they're being hit with. And they have this, you know, they come away from the show thinking, so-and-so is evil, and the show never actually said that, but if you just played the soundtrack in the background, actually, I once made a promise I'll never sing during a talk again, and that's why. So, yeah, there was a conversation. This same thing comes up with simulations. We talked about simulations earlier, and simulations, especially the spreadsheet models type simulation, the way those work are on the basis of rules describing the relations between the various variables. These rules describe the assumptions of the program, but these rules are not typically accessible by the player. SimCity is a good example of that. SimCity, 100%, I've played more SimCity than I can count, 100%, you lower taxes, the economy improves. Think about that. It always works in SimCity because that's part of the rules. So, but is that true in real life? But more to the point, somebody after playing 400 or 500 hours of SimCity, as I did, You come away and you want to vote against taxes, and you don't know how that happens to you, but you have this. And so we need to be careful. We need to make sure that people have the tools to understand this kind of manipulation before we actually start using it.
But the flip side of it, for who here has ever taught in the classroom at any level? Okay, an awful lot of you. I teach at a university. Don't you all do an awful lot to manipulate your students? Like, I get excited when I want them to be excited. And
well, that's why so, I worry, because it's so easy.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that's why I worry.
Right. I guess what you're talking about is more subtle manipulation. Okay, we have one final question, and I'm just going to apologize for the people whose questions I haven't asked, because I've had these brilliant questions here. I've been trying to do my best. We also have the questions on the blog, and what I'm going to ask Ben is maybe he can save the text chat from the blog, and maybe somebody could, I think it would be really great if somebody or myself would type up the questions, the ones that we asked and the ones that we didn't ask, because they've been really wonderful, and I appreciate everybody giving us such great questions. So the last one I'm going to give everybody just a minute to answer is, do you think that e-learning will leave lack of face-to-face contact and interaction? And what might be the impact of lack of face-to-face contact on society? We'll start with Jay.
I don't know that definitions rule my idea of what's best. I think if we can use technology where technology is appropriate, great. And I think people use it to cut off human contact or misdirect it.
Okay, Ross?
It's all about really high-quality interaction, and I think that's the key. And that can happen at a distance, that can happen in a mediated form. Just because you're face-to-face with somebody doesn't mean the interaction is high-quality.
Good point. Last but not least, Stephen.
Yeah, there's this whole online is disembodiment movement being propagated by people like, is it Hubert Dreyfus? I always forget what's Dreyfus. But it's not true, because at no time, whether online or offline, are we ever separated from our bodies. And the thing is, we go on being human. We go to the store, because otherwise we'd die. And we still have friends, and it's just that sometimes our friends live in India or New South Wales. Douglas Rushkoff in Siberia, spelled with a C-Y, wrote that, and he's writing, this is in the mid-90s, he's writing this, and so it's all very new, and he's saying, if you are going to get involved in this industry, expect to do a lot more traveling. And it's sort of counterintuitive, right? Because you don't need to travel anymore. But what happened, my own experience has been, this has been the case, and Jay, with his frequent visits to Dubai, can attest to this. What happens is, instead of being limited to the connections that you can make with the volume of your voice, you can make connections with people around the world. And what happens is, from time to time, you actually go visit them, which is how you end up traveling more. So I would argue the counter position that virtual life actually increases your in-person connections. I would never have met you. I would never have met you. I don't know if I would have met you, because I met you here at a conference in person. So, but these two I never would have met, never in a million years. Had it not been for an online reality. So I'm more socially connected because of the internet. Without the internet, I'd be a hermit.
Should we take a vote on whether that would be a good thing? Hopefully Stephen won't blog me.
Too late.
I want to take the opportunity of thanking our panelists. Haven't they been fantastic? And I think that we all should thank our audience, because you've had, not only have you been patient at the end of 2 days of conference, but these were fantastic questions, so thank you very much. And now I'd like to hand it over to Dale.
Thank you. Well, may I also add my thank you to a very illustrious panel who have challenged us, certainly stretched our self-learning, self-directed learning, and have also given us a great deal of humor. Thank you very much.
Can I say one thing?
You can say one quick thing.
The audio for this text or for this session will be on my website in about half an hour, downs.ca.
Thank you very much, Stephen. And thank you, Lisa, for keeping us under control and on time. We do appreciate it because, yes, there's always more good questions, and hopefully we can see that those get out to you as well.